time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Carly Phelan and Ryan Warswick. Carly Phelan and Ryan Warswick are both with the Seattle Solidarity Network, also known as CSOL. It's a volunteer network of working people supporting fellow workers' strikes and struggles. Carly and Ryan, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
So start out, tell us more about the Seattle Solidarity Network. How did it come about?
You want to, or should I tag in? All right. Seattle Solidarity Network is a mutual support network for workers and tenants. It started back in late November 2007. It was started by a handful of folks from the Seattle chapter of the IWW, that's the Industrial Workers of the World. And it was basically something where people had been working on kind of progressive struggles for some time, depending on, you know, the age of any given founder of it. But they had all kind of come to the same spot, which was, you know, they were seeing more and more people involved in bigger and bigger things, but less and less happening as a result of all of that. And they said, well, what can we do to actually be effective? And how can we actually work in a way where we're accomplishing, you know, whatever goals we set for ourselves, and in doing that, you know, building some kind of new labor movement. And it started out, I think, you know, they had probably 15 to 20 people they could round up for any given action, and they did a couple fights, which were a bit rocky, and then since then it's kind of taken off and been growing steadily.
How many people do you have now?
You're the net duty. You know better than I.
Well, we have
about 550 on the supporters
organizers
list, which is kind of like our general output announcement list.
Yeah, we've got I think it's actually more than that.
Oh, really?
Maybe closer to 100, and then we've got several hundred, upwards of 500 people on sort of a overall sort of general support.
All right.
Volunteers.
And how did you two individually get involved with the organization? What prompted you?
Well, when I graduated from college, my partner at the time and I moved up here, and she promptly looked up the Seattle IWW. She had been loosely involved with them in Olympia. And so the first thing you find on that page at this point is a little link to Seattle Solidarity Network, which is kind of the main working project. They also have a union shop actually at Madison Market in the office, but otherwise a lot of their activity and the people involved in it are also involved in CSOL and put a lot of time and energy into that. And so she got involved and then brought me out to a demand delivery, which is kind of a standard first action for most of our fights. And then I wasn't able to get involved for a little while, went and worked on a boat, had a, you know, decent time as far as the work was concerned, but a terrible time as far as, like, the actual employment was concerned, and came back with basically just one thought of getting more and more involved, really as much as I could.
All right, and Carly?
And I think I was on an IWW mailing list at some point, but I had a friend that kept sending me these texts and emails about actions. I came out to actions probably 6 months or so, maybe a little bit more than that before I actually got more heavily involved. I think it was late 2008 or no, 2009 that I became, fall of 2009 that became an organizer.
All right. Yeah. Now, do people generally come from the IWW for your, the basis of your members, or is it people from all over?
No, not really. I mean, it's pretty broad as far as, I mean, our outreach to the public is concerned. We've put posters all over the place. We've done a number
thousands
of interviews.
And thousands, yeah. Thousands of posters.
There's a lot of word of mouth and people from a variety of organizations and backgrounds.
I mean, most people that get in touch with the IWW probably also get in touch with us.
Yeah.
But it's by no means the prime constituent of our you know, new people coming in or whatnot.
All right, so tell me about some of the actions that your organization has done of late. People approach you when either at work or at home, their living situation is not working out, and they've tried other avenues, and eventually they turn to CSOL.
Yeah.
So the majority of people that do contact us have seen basically a poster near a bus stop, and yeah, they're having an issue with it. Says, you know, problems with your boss or landlord, you know, repairs that haven't been made, you know, you haven't gotten your check or you haven't gotten your last deposit from your landlord. People see those and call us. We do have, you know, we've had more and more sort of word of mouth, friend of a friend sort of way of people getting involved. But the majority is just, you know, somebody has a problem with their boss, sees a poster, and gives us a call.
Yeah, and we have, you know, every week at our meeting, somebody volunteers to basically be on top of returning phone calls. You know, we get anywhere from 5 to 15 calls through either the phone service that we have or the internet, people writing in emails or what have you, and that person for that week is basically in charge of, you know, responding promptly, kind of figuring out quickly enough, you know, does this seem like something that's worth further inquiry or further inquisition? And then if it does, then they'll usually set up or, you know, take the first steps to set up a meeting with that person and a handful, you know, two or three people from CSOL to go and sit down and actually spend, you know, a good hour and a half going through everything they have related to it, figuring out, you know, if it's something that those three think we can take on, what we would be taking on in particular, like what the demand would be, you know, is it something where we want a, you know, landlord company or property management and development company to stop pursuing, you know, some fine that they're pressing against somebody in a, you know, crooked fashion, or is it something where they, you know, cleaned the place that they were living in, they moved out, and then they've had their deposit stolen, or, you know, whatever it might be, kind of formulating that really clearly so that we can bring it back to the group and present it as, you know, this is what we'd propose. We take on this fight, we're fighting for this, it's this company, they have these things that we can target and pressure, and, you know, so on and so forth. And then the group decides there. So.
And do you do your decisions based on democratic process or?
We use direct democracy, and so anybody that comes to a meeting can vote. And yeah, there's a pretty good process, pretty rigorous process for decision making and taking on new fights. It's something that we don't do lightly.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely, I would say, we turn down probably 4 out of 5 potential fights, just because either we're already bogged down in terms of just what we can actually do, our capacity, or, you know, it just doesn't seem like something that's very tangible, or maybe it's not something that, you know, we really think is within our grasp quite yet.
Yeah, winnability is a pretty key principle for us. Obviously, we want to be building, you know, people power, building, you know, giving people that experience of collective action, actually winning some victories. And so, you know, the idea is that we're going to take on fights that we can actually win. And so we're still, you know, we're growing. We've grown just exponentially since I've gotten involved, but we're still a rather small organization. So we want to take on fights that where we actually have enough, you know, we have enough basically volunteers, we have enough time to put pressure on whatever the target company is or entity.
Yeah. And really, I mean, unless we feel like we can commit to something for the long term, we'll tend to avoid taking it on. Like, we do quite well at avoiding losing battles. I mean, the whole idea or the whole sort of ethos of it is we do what we can today so we can do what we want to tomorrow, which is something that it turns out is pretty uncommon. Most people want to jump right to that huge thing that's really like the main problem. It's like, well, yes, it's the main problem, but you don't have anywhere near enough resources to actually settle that. So maybe you should practice and do some other stuff first.
Interesting. So do you have a long-term goal of continuing to grow your organization?
Yes. In short, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, another organizer, Emily, has put it really well once when I was on her mobilizing list and said, you know, kind of what we're looking to do is expand the boundaries of struggle and sort of push it where, you know, push out the boundaries of what we can do and, you know, what, you know, really appears to be and is in fact winnable.
Okay. Do you have attorneys working with you?
No, we don't work with, you know, we don't work within the legal system. Obviously, we work using legal methods, but we rely on lawyers or any kind of experts or media to win the fights. We want people to actually take on their own fights, you know, work with other people just like them and be able to, like, just hit the ground running and get involved. So we have had to employ counsel before, but we certainly don't rely on it to win fights because that doesn't, you know, at least in my opinion, can't speak for everyone in the organization, but that doesn't really build anything long term. That doesn't really build any sort of sense of collective power. And
well, yeah, and I mean, every time you outsource some problem in your life and the resolution of that problem to somebody else, you know, they get a little bit better at dealing with your life and you don't really.
Mm.
All right, so talk about some of the victories that you have encountered both recently and go as far back as you want.
You want to talk about the Chase
site?
Yeah.
Well, we did just beat Chase Bank, which is pretty cool. Yay! We had a fellow, Neftali, who had been in our group for a long time. He came in when his cousin, actually, Alejandro, had a problem with a kind of shady slumlord in Delridge. This guy had been basically renting only to new immigrants, and when they'd move up, he'd sort of slowly jack the rent up until they had to move out, and then taking advantage of the fact that, you know, rarely did they have any, you know, real English skills or what have you, let alone a comprehension of, you know, the United States legal system. And so he would basically pursue them in small claims for it for the maximum allowable amount. And then win by default. Yeah, $5,000. And he had done this like six or seven times by the time Alejandro came to us. And so we fought that, won it, got him to drop the suit. And then in turn, Neftali had gotten involved and stayed around for the last, you know, year and a half at this point. And so he came to us back in March, and he had had this problem where he was about to go on this trip to Canada, and he had gone down to Chase. He was a Chase customer, and he had dropped off money to exchange it into Canadian dollars. And so he had used his, you know, his valid temporary Washington ID, and then he had an expired California ID. And they took that, his identification, just fine when he's dropping off the money. No real surprise there. But he comes back about two or three days later, and the first thing that happens is they're like, oh, you're going to need your passport to pick up your money. And he's kind of like, what? Why? You took my IDs just fine on, you know, Monday. Why is Thursday different? And so they argue back and forth for a bit.
Normally they only would ask him for his debit card. Usually his account information was enough. He was in this branch very, very frequently. He has family that he would send money back to. He was frequently making deposits. He was in this branch often, and he was just dealing with a new person. And
yeah, but he's, you know, brown with an accent in this country. Mm-hmm. So that makes things a little tough sometimes. But yeah, so then eventually, you know, after a bunch of arguing back and forth, the assistant manager came over and was like, look, just let him use his ID, let him get on with it. So at this point, they're both pretty worked up, him and the teller, and they go over, and at this point, she kind of breaks policy. So the idea with money exchange is that, you know, you go in, you give them your money, and they send it off, they outsource that. There's only like one or two places in the city that do it, and then that place returns this sealed envelope to the bank, which you pick up. The idea is the teller should pass it over, you open the envelope, you count out all the money, you look at this receipt that they've produced, you know, an itemized receipt, this many $100 bills, that many $50 bills, so on and so forth. And then you sign it and you leave and everybody's happy. Well, so in his case, they're kind of freaked out or whatever. Teller opens up the envelope, so first kind of snag there, counts out, you know, basically, you know, 600s, however many 50s, however many 20s. Neftali is just kind of in a, you know, wants to get out of there at that point, just grabs money, signs it, and leaves. Goes on his vacation, he comes back and looks at the receipt, and he's like, wait a second, I got, you know, $600 bills, not 16. And so, you know, he thought maybe she was just freaked out, there was this band of hundreds in the envelope or something, maybe she just didn't find it, she was nervous too, something.
The other thing is he usually would exchange into euros, and so he was used to thinking about double the amount, and so that, on top of being really flustered and having somebody question your citizenship status, yeah, you know, made it so that it was an easy mistake to make.
Yeah, well, so anyway, so he goes back, you know, when he realizes this after looking at the receipt, and he starts talking, he's like, oh, come on, look, just look at the video. I know, I'm certain that I did not get these, you know, other $1,000 bills, like, da-da-da-da-da, you know, goes through all the various channels that they allow him to go through, and, you know, and he's like, look, you know, every bank has seven or eight cameras, you know, mostly pointed at the tellers watching the money. They want to watch their hands the whole day long. He's like, look, just look at the video. You'll see she only counts out six. And, you know, first they denied there was a video, and then he started calling higher-ups, and finally, like, okay, well, we have the video, but, you know what, we're not going to watch it with you. We're not going to do that. You can just get out of here. You signed the receipt. We're done. And, you know, this is just yet another example of banks being like, well, we can do whatever we want and you all can just take it or, you know, bank somewhere else, you know, which is sort of an inane proposition. So he got a hold of us and he told us about it, and it was a little different from what we usually do. We hadn't fought a bank before or anything, but it's the same idea of people with a position of power abusing those without. And we had also worked with Neftali at that point for over a year, and we knew him pretty well and really felt good about him and said, all right, well, we'll see what we can do. And so we started that fight on May 31st. And, I mean, do you want to talk about the sequence of events for that?
So the fight started out with the same way that that they all do. So we, the first action, we have a demand delivery. So we've already come up with a very succinct demand, and then and also a time frame for them to meet that demand. And so we give them a letter that says, give, in this case, it was the demand was to give him his $1,000 or show video evidence, you know, to the contrary, that he, you know, that they did not make a mistake. Video evidence they were never able to furnish, by the way, and for good reason.
When we finally settled the fight.
Yeah, but so that was great. So we go and we deliver a demand letter with a large group of people. So we amass, it's usually 30 people. As we've been growing, it's upwards of 40 or 50 sometimes. And we go as a large group and present the demand to the boss or the landlord, or in this case, Chase Bank, the branch manager of Chase Bank. And it's really transformative for people to confront this oppressive, you know, in this case, it's not a boss or a landlord, but this bank. I mean, that's what's more formidable than Chase Bank,
yeah,
you know,
Chase
for
Bank.
An individual to go up against them. But it's great. You know, they go as, you know, we go as a large group of people, and they've got supporters with them. And we don't negotiate or engage in any kind of dialogue or anything at that point. The onus is on them to actually contact us. And they did not for quite a bit.
Nobody ever does. It's always on them.
Yeah, it's always on them. And so then shortly 2 weeks after, we had our first picket. We went to that branch then in downtown Seattle near Westlake Park, had, I think at that point it was 35 people or so, which is not bad for a weekday afternoon. Did sort of an informational picket, passed out flyers.
From there, we started like postering, and then mm-hmm. past that, you know, we did sort of more aggressive pickets with, you know, noisemakers and things like that, and lots of picket signs and whatnot. And then we even actually went so far as to do something that, to my knowledge, we hadn't really done before, but it was a roving picket, and we did two of these actually, where, you know, we hit up four or five different branches of Chase Bank downtown, and sort of each one for 15 to 20 minutes, you know, pots and pans banging, making a bunch of noise, and just basically creating a general disruptive disturbance. And, you know, when I say postering, I said that earlier, like what I mean is, you know, we would make these posters that are like, you know, watch out if you bank at Chase, you know, count your money twice, and, you know, little funny images or whatever. And then we'd go out and put, you know, 30 or 40 of those up in any given night. And we'd have, you know, because we're all volunteer and we all sort of have our own schedules, you know, people at the meetings would be like, well, I can go on, you know, Tuesday night, and I'll go, you know, Wednesday morning, and I'll go, you know, Thursday afternoon.
We're just constantly hammering them, basically.
Yeah. You know, the idea being that, you know, we for ourselves anyway, clarify pressure into three general categories, typically. I know it's not a science, it's certainly open to change, but it's sort of useful for our intents and purposes. And we start, you know, kind of thinking, well, we have an emotional pressure. And so that's when, you know, a big group of people shows up and is like, you did something wrong. And that's, you know, maybe intimidating, or maybe like pulls on their heartstrings if they're not just an awful person already or something, or sociopath. But it's not actually something that's going to force their hand that much, right? And so above that, we have, like, public shame pressure. So that's where we have, like, the, you know, informational flyering, the pickets, things like that. And then finally, there's, you know, economic pressure, where you really start to actually try and put it in just dollars and cents. You say, look, we're going to make it more expensive for you to resist this than to give into this.
And economic pressure is probably the sort of strategy that we use, sort of tactic that we used most. In this case, it's a little bit different because we're dealing with Chase Bank, putting economic pressure on them. We did discuss, I mean, we were ready to escalate to a number of different things, including divestment. But how much that can actually, you know, affecting their bottom line is a lot different than going up against a property developer who wants to rent, you know, a unit, or a restaurant that is trying to sell, you know, is trying to get customers. I mean, actually picketing outside there and turning customers away does affect them. And as far as how the fight goes, we have, after that demand delivery, we're using basically an escalating set of tactics. So we're always putting more and more pressure on them. So it's, as Ryan said, much easier for them to give in at a certain point than to continue fighting us. And that generally is much easier to give in an economic sense.
Yeah.
But in this case, it was a little bit different.
Yeah, we couldn't possibly hope to hurt Chase that much right now, as far as, like, we're going to crush you, Chase, if you don't give in to this $1,000 demand. But we could definitely make it very difficult for them. I mean, they're a company that's basically just recently trying to move into our neck of the woods, that is to say the Pacific Northwest. And so, you know, they have huge ad campaigns. You see them everywhere you go, billboards, signs, what have you, all those little campaigns, commercials, and so forth. So it's really clear that they're trying to make a good impression, which it turns out is contradicted by large groups of angry people banging pots and pans in front of your branch. But, you know, we also did something where we went and we went and talked to all of this branch manager's neighbors. You know, went there from like 5:30 to 7 one evening, waiting for people to get home, just be like, hey, did you know your neighbor is involved in this? You know, Susanna, you know, Miss Baldridge. Did you know that, you know, she's having this, you know, this issue, she's refusing to do this, she did this to this guy, and, you know, kind of working that whole shame angle and really putting pressure on as many of the various limbs of this enormous entity as we could, as we had access to. And, like, part of our escalation was going to include, if we had had to move to it, moving up to, you know, basically moving up the ranks. You know, moving after the district manager or the regional manager and things like that, and just basically bringing as much of their business in as we could.
But the idea there, too, is to make it, you know, not just making it personal to be difficult, but in this case, it's such a huge chase and such a huge entity that we needed to go after, you know, the people that I actually make the decision to give him his $1,000 back, the branch manager, the regional manager, et cetera. And so that's why we focused on those people, specifically on those people versus on Chase Bank. Don't bank with Chase.
And what do you believe were the actual, where the threshold was on this one? When you won, so clearly they gave him the money.
We had a funny experience with this, actually. Neftali was out of town for like 3 weeks at one point. He was visiting in Mexico. He's got, I think, dual citizenship or something, and so he was going back there to renew his Mexican citizenship. And so he's out of town. And during this time that he's out of town, we did roving picket an ungodly amount of postering. Like, I know at least once I went out and with a couple other people put up 120 posters in just this little one intersection. And that was also the period where we went to this woman's apartment complex and talked to all of her neighbors. You know, we were doing all sorts of stuff, and he gets back and we heard nothing. They never called us or anything. We're like, crap, what's going on? And he gets back, and like 2 days after he gets back, calls us and says, hey, you know, I've got 4 messages from the district manager, and he sounds really happy. And the last time we talked, he was yelling at me, and it was just like, oh my God. And so it was, you know, somewhere along that line. What they really talked about, I actually went to the meeting that we had to resolve all this. It was myself, Neftali, and another organizer, Tefra. And after a failed attempt to keep the two of us out of the meeting, we went in and sat down. And mostly what this guy, who's the district manager, Brent, talked about was the personal harassment. I mean, he talked about basically the pressure that we had put on Susanna Baldridge, on the branch manager in particular. As being really like what they needed to stop. Because, I mean, if you think about it, she must have been, and this is why we kind of target the lowest possible target that we can at first, you know, that we think can actually give in this case, the branch manager. Because, you know, by doing that, she's there, you know, calling HR, she's there calling her managers, you know, whatever, and saying, mm-hmm. like, why aren't you guys helping me deal with this? Yeah. Why aren't you guys putting this to rest or somehow, like, working with me on this? Like, this has got to stop. They're coming to my home. So on and so forth, which means that not only do we have the opportunity to do our own outside pressure, but she's working for us inside.
So about 4 minutes left. So according to your website, you're doing everything everything you're doing is legal.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
mm-hmm.
numerous times when people you're picketing or whatever, call the police show up, it sounds like. And
pretty much every time.
They turn around and leave because they see that nothing illegal is happening.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, we have especially any kind of actions that we have in downtown Seattle, the police maybe are more familiar with protests and things. We're always so aware of our rights, number one, and then number two, we're not doing anything illegal.
Yeah. Don't block the doors, don't block the sidewalk, and you're pretty much fine.
All right. And then quickly, what's your response then to people that would say that you're going to people's, let's say, homes, talking to their neighbors is like taking it too far?
So, you know, I think, you know, Ryan used the term, quoting that guy about, quoting Brent about personal harassment or what have you. That's their term, obviously not ours. We're simply holding them accountable. We're going as a large group maybe and picketing or putting up some flyers. We're not, you know, at their door all of the time. We're not harassing them. On the flip side, you know, a lot of Chase customers have been harassed by Chase people when they call in just to try to resolve an issue with, you know, a mortgage or their bank account. And to saying it's taking it too far, I mean, at what point do you stand up for yourself and do you say, look, I'm not you, why are they allowed to step on us and we can't fight back?
Yeah.
I think it's a sort of internalized, you know, victim status. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's very useful for people to feel that way, but I've yet to come to any good reason why one should.
It's direct action.
Yeah.
Direct action.
Which, for the record, we usually define as, well, for one thing, it gets the goods. For another, you know, direct action, we use that word a lot, but just in case people don't know what that term means, a handy definition is direct action is the direct response of the working class to the problems of the working class without, you know, delegation, without looking to other people that are specialists or professionals to solve their problems.
All right. So just a couple minutes left. So how can people get involved, find out more about your organization?
Well, they can go to our website, seesol.net, SEASOL.net, NET. And
in case they didn't know.
And they can also email us, info@seesol.net, info@seesol.net. And they can also call us at 206-350-8650.
350-8650. Yep. Yeah, and there's always work to do. I mean, we've got, I think we've got three fights running now. We just took on two new ones. And so, you know, there's bound to be a bunch of work coming up pretty quickly here.
Can you briefly, real quickly, tell us about one of those? So give people a taste.
What do you think? The Doms, I don't know about. One is with a girl who it's a fairly convoluted fight, but to give the main bullet point, is basically she's this like 20-year-old girl who in the last 2 years has been, after living in a place for 3 months, has basically been paying $200 a month since then. This is since like February 2010, and you know she was 18 or 19 when that started.
Tricked into this payment arrangement that she, because she didn't know her rights at the time, and they just absolutely took advantage of her.
Yeah, and so she's in this kind of weird debt peonage situation where, like, they basically claim that she still owes a couple grand. She's already paid them, like, $3,700. The rent total for the time she lived there was, like, really after some assistance she got from the Salvation Army, was, like, $1,550. So, you know, she's already paid past the amount of rent from when she lived there, about $2,000, you know, to the tune of $2,150. And they still expect another, you know, double that amount. So, like, it's pretty nuts what people try and get away with. I mean, it's in their interest to do that, you know, from the perspective of the landowning or the, you know, company-owning class. You know, every time they get away with it, it makes it worth it. But that's why we're here, so that shit stops.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
We've just been talking with Carly Phelan and Ryan Worswick, both with the Seattle Solidarity Network, also known as CSOL, and you can find out more about their organization at their website, seesol.net.